Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. Well, happy Monday, everyone, and we'll be discussing a little later in the show some of the continued news coming out of Palestine, and we're also going to be talking a bit about where the NAACP Black Politics stand currently, as well as the upcoming Constituent Assembly in Venezuela. But before we can move on, Eric Prince, yes, formerly of Blackwater, was on NPR recently, and he was discussing his desire to turn Afghanistan into a U.S. vice royalty policed and controlled by private military contractors, although it doesn't have to be him. The report asked one question, the reporter asked one question, noting the fact that Prince's own firm was convicted of war crimes in Iraq and that many private military corporations have questionable ethics. The general question was along the lines of whether or not it's fair to question handing over all power to private armies once one considers that history. Prince, unsurprisingly, did not really view that as an issue and raised a whole number of canards, one of which, though, is crucial. And his first point was to categorically reject the idea that the U.S. should leave Afghanistan, terming that as something along the lines of the quote-unquote terrorist, quote-unquote winning. And this, in some ways, is exactly the point about the hubris of a lot of elite Americans, especially in the foreign policy sphere, where the very idea that the people of a country should determine who rules their country seems to be foreign. The U.S. has presided over two completely fraudulent elections in Afghanistan while claiming to cultivate a democracy. For a country constantly claiming to promote freedom and democracy, it's shocking that literally no one in the mainstream of U.S. politics is calling for an outright end to the Afghanistan war. If the fact that after all this time that the Taliban controls more territory than at any time since 2001 isn't a clear statement that America should get out and wasn't ever really welcome in the first place, I don't know what does. If all U.S. politicians are saying no one has the right to intervene in American internal affairs, what gives this country the right to just not just intervene, but outright determine, without question, the future of Afghanistan, regardless of what Afghans actually want? The double standards are all over the place in D.C. these days, but this one is costing thousands of lives, and judging by NPR, even thinking Eric Prince has any legitimacy on this issue makes one believe it may cost thousands more before it's over. The Centers for Disease Control, based out of Atlanta, the CDC as it's often known, has a new appointed director. Trump put him in there. Filling the job will be former Georgia State Health Commissioner Dr. Brenda Fitzgerald, who's an OBGYN if you care. In the most general sense, Fitzgerald appears to be someone with extensive experience in the area, but not one without some issues. In particular, some are accusing her of being in the pocket of Big Sugar and someone who may not take seriously the role of sugary drinks in the spread of many deadly diseases, including type 2 diabetes. Obviously, the job of the CDC is serious and wide-ranging. It also sets the tone on many public health issues. And in 2013, you may remember, the CDC broke ties with Coca-Cola after it determined that Coke's mission did not square with the CDC's due to the effect of soft drinks on the health of the nation. Now, Fitzgerald told the New York Times over the weekend she'd be willing to walk that decision back. And on top of that, when health commissioner in Georgia, she took $1 million allegedly to fight childhood obesity from Coke. Now, this raises major red flags for public health advocates who point out how soda companies and Big Sugar in general have been trying to pull a bit of a sleight of hand here, in particular by trying to direct the science on the issue to establish that basically sugary drinks play no role in childhood obesity or any other problems as long as kids or anyone else continues to exercise regularly. And in fact, one of the advisory board members of Georgia's youth exercise initiative that was put forward here by Fitzgerald was a top Coke executive who had to leave the company over a scandal involving attempts to steer funds towards scientists who would agree with the conclusions that sugary drinks aren't really an issue, that it's just lack of exercise. Now, the CDC, as you might imagine, has taken the opposite view that regardless of exercise, quote, frequently drinking sugar-sweetened beverages is associated with weight gain / obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, kidney diseases, non-alcoholic liver disease, tooth decay and cavities, and gout, a type of arthritis, end quote. Which makes sense when one notes, as the New York Times does, that the average person would have to run about 3 miles to offset the calories in a single 20-ounce serving of soda, depending on weight and speed. In other words, you do need to exercise, but even the most exercise in the world can't help you if your diet is terrible. And this is something soda companies and other big sugar companies spend huge amounts of money on politicians to avoid. You may be familiar with the fights these companies have waged against more accurate food labeling and against bans on large beverages. They also, as you may imagine, spend lots of money on politicians. In addition to just fighting against health regulations, the raw sugar producers are raking in billions in agricultural subsidies. In 2014, the top five pro-sugar groups spent $8 million in lobbying. Even Bernie Sanders took $20,000 for a recent Senate race from the American Crystal Sugar PAC. Secret trips to the Dominican Republic by the FanJul Family Sugar Empire based in Florida and the Dominican Republic are so frequent and so corrupt that famous Dominican-American writer Junot Diaz called the FanJul spread in the DR, quote, the resort that shame forgot. Now the sugar barons, it seems, have a friend on the inside just where they need one. Olive Yang died last week at 90 years old. You probably have no idea who she is, but in short, she was the CIA's first drug dealer. Mrs. Yang was part of a CIA plan to overthrow the People's Republic of China. Some sections of the Kuomintang government that ruled briefly in China between World War II and 1949 fled the country following the communist ascendancy. Many of them wound up in Burma, where the CIA helped them to set up a rebel army to harass the Chinese government with. As many may have forgotten, the phrase, quote, who lost China, was one of the biggest political issues of the late 1940s and was a major precipitating factor in the onset of McCarthyism. As such, maintaining some level of support for the political forces that the U.S. had backed ended up being a very important thing for the U.S. government to do. Now, as Alfred McCoy details quite clearly in his, I would say, magisterial book titled The Politics of Heroin, these rebels financed their operations through selling opium. They pioneered the routes from Burma across the Thai border into Bangkok and other cities where the opium was then distributed around the world. The CIA had no issue with this and would also fly weapons into Thailand, and the guns would come back the same way the opium went out. And this became the nexus of the massive heroin trade that not too long after would cause a major crisis of addiction in the United States. It was known and tolerated by the U.S. a little later on that its South Vietnamese puppet government made tons of money off of this heroin trade, and by plying heroin to the war-weary GIs helped supercharge the market for it. So yes, in a very direct way, the United States helped create the mass heroin trade to facilitate their political goals and fund insurgents off book. And this, of course, was repeated in Afghanistan in the 1980s and again in the most recent conflict. The AP even wrote a headline in 2010, quote, U.S. allies tolerate heroin trade, end quote, about how U.S. troops during Obama's Afghan surge happily looked the other way, as the U.S. had done all along with top allies of former President Hamid Karzai, accused of the same. Rolling Stone even charged the U.S. with creating a narco state in Afghanistan, given how much control drug lords seemed to have over the country when their reporters visited in 2014. There's also, of course, the most infamous case, and that's the involvement of the CIA in the crack cocaine trade. While many of the exact details are disputed, the basic story broken by Gary Reb of the San Jose Mercury News, who's driven to suicide for revealing this, have been totally vindicated. The U.S. was well aware the Contras were dealing coke to fund their efforts to overthrow the socialist government in Nicaragua. They knew that coke was ending up on the street and being turned into crack. They knew there was a direct relationship then between the cocaine trade their rebel friends were helping along and the crack epidemic ravaging America. So in sum, it's worth remembering that the CIA has been one of the key players in the global drug trade since the end of World War II. Sit with that for a minute, then remember it the next time someone tells you to believe what the CIA says uncritically. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, an economic movement shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined here as we continue our conversation, switching gears a little bit here, by James Early, who's the former director of cultural and heritage policy at the Center for Folk Life and Cultural Heritage at the Smithsonian Institution and also a board member at the Institute for Policy Studies. James, thank you so much for being with us again.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
No, of course, of course. Pleasure is all mine. So I wanted to start here with one of the, well, there's a lot of issues here, but one of the issues that I really wanted to really touch on is the NAACP convention, which is happening this year in Baltimore. And, you know, it's quite interesting to me, and a lot of people have asked me this question, what's the efficacy of the NAACP? Is it still worthwhile? Are they at a crossroads? Obviously, the AME Church also coming out just prior to this convention with a letter condemning the direction to a large degree of the organization, saying that they were out of touch with the younger generation. So I think it's a very interesting time here, really sort of at a crossroads for the country, certainly a crossroads, I think, for the Black Liberation Movement in the wake of what we saw the past 3 years for the movement for Black Lives. I mean, your thoughts on the relevance, efficacy, importance of the NAACP at this junction?
Well, the NAACP is the oldest and purportedly the largest civil rights organization, still has some strong roots within the African-American community. However, those roots don't respond to the urgency of policy needs, which each of its conventions is to address for the coming year. And so I think there is an outstanding question of whether its relevancy is reflected in taking on the main policy issues. After all, it's in the city of Baltimore. So will police brutality as a systemic issue, as has been noted by the activists in Minnesota recently with the killing of a white woman, that has brought out a multiracial protest, and where they don't personalize it by simply looking at the individuals who were at fault, by looking at structural, systemic, their term was institutional issues. Will the NAACP address the institutional issues of Baltimore? I think that's doubtful. Will they address police brutality against the Black community by going directly at the police, not talking about body cameras, but actually calling out the police to say, who are the most liberal and progressive-minded police people? You must step forth in coalition with citizen demands. That would be a pointed approach. I don't think the NAACP will come to that. Will they question the greatest formal threat to U.S. democracy, which is not Russian intervention, important as that might be, but voter suppression? Will there be a sustained focus on voter suppression? I doubt they will call that out as a consistent level. So there is a question here about the relevancy of the NAACP. And periodically, there is the relevant charge that it is not addressing the younger generation, dreamers, the Black Lives Matter, other young adult social activist protests.
Mm-hmm. No, I think the good points there, and certainly very relevant. And, you know, the letter from the AME bishops to them, I thought was quite interesting because it made some similar points about not really being able to deal with some of the points in the conjuncture. But it also raised, I thought, relatively explicitly that they felt one of the reasons why the NAACP was moving with feet of clay, if you will, was their funding mechanism. They were taking too much money from corporations, basically, and someone mentioned somewhere tobacco companies, although I have not actually confirmed that, but that would be shocking to me. But nevertheless, do you think that is a Achilles heel, if you will, for the work they're trying to do there?
Well, economic relations, systemic, sustained economic relationships do impact and influence consciousness and impact activity. So, yes, that is a factor. But I don't think it's the first factor or the primary factor. The primary factor is the NAACP willing to be a fighting organization based on the objective needs of our communities? And so that is not a question of money. That is a question of focus and will and organizing especially in support of a younger generation of adult African-Americans and other people of color who are in action without money and who are having impact in their communities. So that's really the first instance. I think the upshot of the money question is that there is too cushy or a comfortable relationship with status quo people. When you look at the range of speakers there from communities of color, you know, you've got the Democratic Party status quo basically coming. Bernie Sanders will be speaking to it, but these are sectoral issues. What is the through line? What is the horizontal line that connects the entire conference? What is the agenda? If you go up on the website, there is a lot of touting of that Johns Hopkins is there and the harbor. It's an attractive city to come to and things you can do. That's not a political agenda. That's a kind of happy-go-lucky conference. Although they will have some serious issues they will look at, that does not really reflect the serious and urgent nature of the needs, particularly of the Black community in Baltimore and of people of color more generally, keeping in mind that the National Association for Colored People was not just Black people. That was one of the things that W.E.B. Du Bois and the founding of the NAACP insisted that the term colored was to look at all of the people of color, because he was looking at the anti-colonial movement of Southeast Asians against European colonialism, as well as on the African continent, as well as the struggle against systemic racialized capitalism in the United States. So there is an outstanding question, and it's good that this challenge is coming before the NAACP, because otherwise it's a waste of human resources and money, and it diverts us from the agendas that are coming up in communities that are more organic, fighting systemic racism, fighting the systemic unequal expressions that arise from a moribund capitalism in which greed has just overrun everything, including common sense.
No, I think very relevant historical point there, too. I was actually, when you were saying that, trying to remember in my own mind what was the last international issue I can remember the NAACP speaking out on. And I can't remember one. I think it might have been Haiti in 94. But be that as it may, you know, I think I'm curious what you think the former NAACP figure now, Reverend Barber from North Carolina, who's now doing his own thing, Repairs of the Breach. I don't know if it was that. I don't know if that in and of itself is a commentary on the NAACP. But do you think he's been hitting a little bit more of a right note as a former board member about what the sort of quote unquote civil rights challenges of the 21st century are?
Yes, he has been hitting the right note. And in a very broad sense, he is a concentrated expression of a most advanced moral, ethical perspective across the Black communities and communities in general in the U.S. by he's going directly, not just speaking truth to power, but challenging power and trying to change dimensions of power by bringing us back to that important moment and where Martin Luther King connected in the most sharp way the issue of racial identity and the struggle against racism with the issue of economic class identity, which was not anti, but it was pro. What are we trying to transform, not just what we stand against? And so that the refocus on the poor people of this country, led by an African-American social gospel minister, who is not complaining that he does not have enough funds or enough corporate support, but who has been on the front lines of challenging white supremacy and challenging the objective economic egregious issues of U.S. capitalism and its negative impact, particularly on the Black community, but communities in general. That should be really the central focus, which would then connect all of the other issues of police brutality that goes on in Baltimore and other cities and some of the other urgent issues. But let's go back to your point for a moment about the international issues, because this is how Black mainstream leadership within the Democratic Party has been socialized by and large only to address internal issues to the Black community, not broad national issues and certainly not international issues. And for all of the focus of leading Black spokespeople, including Representative Cummings, who's from Baltimore in the U.S. Congress, on Russia, where is the focus on Haiti? Where is the focus on Brazil, where officially 52% of the population is Black, with the greatest, perhaps the greatest class divide in the world? Where is the focus on the fact that Black Venezuelans have repeatedly since 1999 supported the Bolivarian Revolution? Where is the focus on Africans who have been drowning trying to get into Europe long before the Syrian crisis?
Right. Well, we're going to put a pin in it right here, but we'll come back to this here after the break with James Early on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking a little bit about some of the political issues flowing out of the NAACP convention, the Minneapolis, in the wake of the resigning of the Minneapolis police chief, and then also in the context of the international space. And where you left off, James, I think is a very relevant point. We are joined here by James Early, board member of the Institute for Policy Studies and formerly with the Smithsonian Institution. Where you left off there, I think, is a very important point, and that's the issue of sort of the international perspective. And you had connected it historically to W.E.B. Du Bois originally raising this issue and the creation of the NAACP and kind of the waning, if you will. And I think in some ways the Russia thing to me is very indicative of the shallowness of any international discussion in black politics. I mean, it's been surprising to me that the backlash from anyone really, but certainly from other CBC members around Barbara Lee's authorization of use of military force passes the House in a bipartisan manner, totally kneecapped by Paul Ryan, who doesn't want to even deal with the issue at all, wants a blank check for war making. And I just thought, man, first of all, great action on the part of Barbara Lee and to continue and consistently raise this issue. But the fact that this is like her issue and most of these other people weren't necessarily, even they were voting for it, aggressively backing her up, coming out with talking points, making this a political issue, trying to at least among black America. I mean, it just seemed a little bit shocking to me and perhaps somewhat concomitant with the fact that Paul Ryan so easily pushed it to the side.
Well, you know, the Black Caucus's commitment to the Democratic Party first and foremost over a real agenda, not just for black Americans, but for poor and other marginalized Americans, is the big contradiction. So notwithstanding the stalwart role that Barbara Lee has played and did play around the Iraq War, what is their relationship to the attempt at a social democratic politic within the Democratic Party, which is personified in Bernie Sanders? There is no obvious conversation, as far as I can determine, no strategic conversation going on about a social democratic trend that would attempt to harmonize, to lower the egregious contradictions within capitalist racist America. It's not a radical revolutionary perspective, but it would be a major step beyond the duopoly that we have, that Karen Bass, Barbara Lee, Cummings, John Lewis from Atlanta, Georgia, that all of them sit within the Democratic Party upholding that framework, which has produced nothing on a consistent level to advance the concerns of black folk, poor, and other working class people. So, and on the international issue, they bow to all of this Cold War canards that comes from the anti-communism perspective, looking towards this critique of Russia. And I think there should be a critique of the interference into the democratic electoral system of the United States. But that's not the principal issue that black people are facing. All of the black people who are starving in North Africa what's going on in Yemen. Where is black leadership? Where is Latino progressive and Asian Pacific American and LGBTQ leadership in the Congress? This is the challenge that ordinary citizens have to bring, because people are being sent to wars. The United States is in continuous wars. Working class kids of all racial ethnic backgrounds are being sent out there in the name of some abstract patriotism. And this is where we really have to force the issue with people like the NAACP, with black congressional caucus members, and other liberal and so-called progressive people within the U.S. Congress.
Mm. Well, I think it's a relevant point. And before I switch issues here, I just want to say, I mean, to some degree, is maybe what's underlying all of this is a disconnect in some ways between sort of popular politics and electoral politics vis-a-vis the black community in a way that I think sort of historically was less. I mean, if we think of the first wave of black politicians, I don't even know, I'm pulling one out of my head here, Coleman Young or someone like that, you know, people who whatever later on happened, Maynard Jackson, were coming out of some recognizable popular upsurge for black mayors and more black politicians and so on and so forth, and had kind of Marion Barry in D.C., good example, and had a different relationship, even if one that was also problematic in different ways, with the community, where now, you know, sort of in a way where you used to have some sort of, well, did you come out of this or come out of that, you can kind of parachute in the same way consultants parachute in candidates anywhere, and that the sort of candidates themselves aren't really motivated by the same, good, bad, or indifferent, aren't really accountable to the same institutions or whatever the way they used to be.
I think that's an accurate description. They are now generalized professional politicians accountable to their organization, in this case, the Democratic Party, not to the popular movements that put them there. And it's part of the development of what has often been termed bourgeois democracy, in which the class issues, individuals are able to step forward, pursue their own interests, their own professional interests as politicians, and not be social individuals who are actually stewards of the aspirations and concerns and needs of the communities to which they are rooted. So this is a challenge that remains, that has to be critiqued, because the economic system in which we are living is not producing. It consistently is downgrading the quality of life, particularly of black people and other people of color, and that we have to kick these politicians out, not just critique them. We have to kick them out, and we have to bring representatives from the popular movement who are talking about the institutional systemic nature, as we saw with the protests against the police chief and the mayor just a few days ago in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm glad you ended there, because that was my segue into the next piece, which is this Minneapolis piece. I mean, interesting to see. I've seen a bulk of different reactions to the police chief resigning there in the wake of this most recent police shooting. Obviously, a lot of people felt well justified. Minneapolis police have had a lot of issues. Even seeing the mayor maybe was a little fed up with the police chief. A lot of other folks pointing out what they felt was a little bit of a double standard, that the police chief of Minneapolis was resigning after this shooting, which took on a big role for some people would say because the victim was white. Some people would also say because she was from another country that's a prominent U.S. ally, maybe some combination of the two there, that if said somehow it's another slap in the face of the black community, that this is the case that a police chief resigns on, not that a police chief hasn't resigned when a black person's been killed before. But nevertheless, I understand the general line of discussion. But in Minneapolis itself, seems that there's pretty big jubilation over the fact the woman is gone, regardless of however it took place. So, I mean, I'm curious how you're parsing some of those aspects of the police chief stepping down, and even the shooting itself, which was, to me, an unbelievable sort of role reversal on what we normally see, but from a sort of step-by-step standpoint, very similar to how the police end up killing a lot of people.
Well, this is, I think that the Minneapolis situation presents us with some complexities that we really do need to unravel. What we have is a culture of policing, seeing police not as civil servants, but as a class unto themselves. And this has been the right wing's vantage point, that police people are special citizens, not like ordinary citizens, and that institution must be protected. That means that while white supremacy pervades the institution, male chauvinism pervades the institution. It's just not a matter of saying a white policeman. I'm also frightened by black and Latino and other ethnic police people who are inculcated in that culture, as well as women, despite the sexism that goes on within that system. They are part of that culture in which the ordinary citizen, particularly the citizen of color, the black citizen, especially within that context, is sort of ipso facto a danger. So what we are seeing here is a culture played out. I think the outcry that we have seen is very telling and useful, and what pointing us in perhaps a new direction. On the one hand, I think clearly that the person was white has brought a different kind of attention. I think also that it was a woman is an object that probably plays there. But most significant, in my observation, has been the response on the part of the activist citizens. they clearly said this is not just a matter of removing an individual. They used the term, this is an institutional problem. This is a structural problem. This is a systemic problem. It is what policing is about that is the problem. Policing is directed against the least of the community. These bail issues where people who can't pay are just thrown into jail, and tax dollars are thrown to build jails and to food services and other kinds of commodifying working class and poor people without having established whether they are guilty or not because they're unable to pay bail for something that they have been charged with. So if we follow that black-white coalition that was so prominently displayed in the protests against the Minneapolis mayor, where the black man stepped forward and called this an institutional problem, and then a white woman steps forward and she gives the empirical data over a long period of time of what's been happening, and then you see them embrace, cheering one another. That's a good sign of people-driven democracy that we should try to build on and get away from simply personifying this as here's an individual that must be taken care of, and getting away from this technocratic issue of why weren't the cameras turned on. That's important that the cameras were not turned on, but just simply having cameras has not proven useful in protecting black lives, and in this instance, the life of a white woman.
Mm-hmm. You know, it also just stressed again for me, and certainly this is nothing new in any way, shape, or form as it concerns black liberation, the international issue. You know, Australia is not a country that gets reported on a lot in the United States, but there was mass outrage all across the country. And it's very difficult for me not to think that that had to have an impact. I'm sure, for instance, most people in the Trump administration probably aren't that bothered by police shootings, but you might be way more bothered if people start to bring it up. I mean, we've had countries like the Bahamas issue travel advisories to its own residents to be wary of the police. You had the UAE when the kid from the Emirates was shot in Ohio. They sent like their own government investigators because they were like, we can't trust the U.S. government. And it just seems that everybody knows that this is a huge issue in America, both here and around the world. And there's been some moves, I know, to sort of raise this at the UN level and so on and so forth. But it just seems like the importance of that is really reaffirmed in my mind, seeing the way this played out and how quickly we went from shot to the woman being shot to the police chief stepping down.
Right. Well, certainly in the international arena, I mean, everybody does recognize the systemic and grave nature of police brutality, particularly against the black community and other communities of color. And they also understand the broader cultural issue is that this militarization of the police department is way out of balance to what is required in any society. However, we should be careful by aligning ourselves fully with this international outrage. Australia, after all, is one of the most racist countries in the entire world, vis-a-vis the Aboriginal population, vis-a-vis immigrants who were put off in little islands and kept out on boats and who are not admitted to the country, who have a relationship to send them all the way to the United States. So we should use this outrage on the part of the state and the broad population of Australia. But at the same time, we should bring this attention, as did W.E.B. Du Bois, who understood that in the NAACP discussion, the term color was not just black and white in the United States, but it was all the people, quote unquote, of the Asiatic Sea, where colonialism, racialized colonialism, capitalism was taking root. And where people beyond their class backgrounds were marginalized because of their ethnicity, because of their religion, because of the color of their skin. So we can utilize the outrage on the part of the state of Australia as well as on their citizens. But let's also bring attention that this is a global issue, this systemic racism that is manifest in police killings all over. The Washington Post, just a year and a half, 2 years ago, reported that on average, 7 black people are killed in Brazil by the police every day. We don't have 7 people in the United States being killed every day, but there is a way in which we can be overly focused on what goes on in the United States and miss the systemic nature of worldwide racism.
Mm-hmm. No, very, very good point. Strangely auspicious, while we were recording this, I got a text from someone who was in Brazil working on police brutality a few months ago. So weird happenings here, but nevertheless, I wanted to raise quickly here. We got about 4 minutes left, so not a lot to say here, but your thoughts on the importance of this upcoming constituent assembly in Venezuela, which will be this Sunday.
This constituent assembly in Venezuela is critically important, not only in Venezuela, but across Latin America and the Caribbean in particular, because it represents the most recent and perhaps last effort to save the accumulated gains of the Bolivarian Revolution, which has redounded to the advancement of the most marginalized citizens in those communities. That's what Hugo Chavez was about. And with all of the complexities and contradictions here, the fact is that the Bolivarian government under Maduro does represent the accumulated gains of that revolution. And then in that context, we must also critically look at Maduro's inability to deal with the political situation. If you're in leadership, you've got to deal with it. You just can't complain about capitalism and imperialism. Although those are the priority factors, and we must not lose sight of this, and progressives and leftists must support the democratically elected government of Maduro and through this constituent assembly. But at the same time, we must be able to hold more than two things in our mind, an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist position and a pro-Bolivarian position. There is a third position of leftists and progressives who are in power. We must also have a consistent, constant, ongoing, critical examination of where the errors and the failures are. There's a lot of corruption in the government in Venezuela. The Cubans have talked about the corruption in their own country. This is Cuban communists and Cuban socialists, including led by its president, Raul Castro. So as we must support this constituent assembly because it is within the context of the Constitution, and we must be against the imperial invasions and the threat of invading that country that is being organized. And Donald Trump now is contemplating, and we may know in the next few days, of cutting off oil, buying Venezuelan oil and supplying Venezuela with light oil, which makes that their crude oil more easily consumable in the international market. So as complex and problematic as the issues are in the Maduro government, it does represent the generalized will of the people and the advances of the Bolivarian Revolution, and it must be critically supported.
No, I think that's very true. I think it seems like the real question in some ways up for debate at the Constituent Assembly is what are the substantive answers given by the different forces that contend within that assembly to the problems that are existing in the country today. And I don't know if they'll come to a deep consensus over that. So it may be interesting how that plays out. It certainly will be key to how the rest of the country, the rest of the world rather, is continues to relate to the process as it moves forward. And so, final minute here, I just wanted to ask you, real quickly, I mean, do you think that there is a special importance in what is happening in Venezuela because of what Chavez did to try to reclaim Afro-Venezuelan and indigenous consciousness in a country where that had been so elided from the top for so many years?
No question about it. It is critically important because Chavez stood forth and recognized his own African heritage and was very openly and consistently self-critical for not having given special affirmative policy attention to Afro-Venezuelans in the 1999 Constitution, as they did to indigenous communities, the elderly, and other groups who needed specialized attention because of the history of their marginalization and exploitation and the gravity of their needs. And I must say, from direct experience of having met with Maduro on a number of occasions myself, being invited there, to meet with him along with some others, they have not been consistent in their focus on Afro-Venezuelans. And Afro-Venezuelans continue, appropriately so, to support the Maduro government, but they are showing other citizens what critical support should be about. They're also criticizing the government, even as they support it, because they know that the right-wing opposition of elites in Venezuela, who are also aligned with elites in Colombia and Argentina and Brazil and with Washington, D.C., represent a grave danger to their life circumstances. But they see the possibilities, given the history since 1999, with the Maduro government.
Right.
And one of the outstanding questions after this is, what will Maduro do at the Constituent Assembly? How will they look at leadership going forward?
No, absolutely. It's going to be big. Well, thank you so much. That was James Early talking to us here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. We're going to take another break. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about some of the continued news coming out of Palestine, and we are very happy to be joined here by Jonathan Kutab, who is a Palestinian human rights lawyer. Mr. Kutab, thank you so much for joining the show.
You're most welcome.
So I wanted to start with the continuing, I don't know if the right word here is controversy, it sounds too small bore, but over what is happening at Al-Aqsa Mosque. And now after some civil disobedience there, the Israeli government, I believe, has put up some metal detectors and security cameras, really in some ways trying to, I think, put a bit of a chilling effect on any Muslims looking to come visit the site. And certainly major issue. Six people have been killed. It really just seems that the Israeli government and Mr. Netanyahu, it almost seems like they're trying to create controversy here. Your thoughts on this situation?
Well, actually, the security people, the professionals in Israel have made it very clear that these cameras aren't and these metal detectors are not a good move to make right now. And it was a political decision, basically, to insist on it as an assertion of Israeli control and exclusive control over Jerusalem. The arrogance, I think, involved in that decision is totally counterproductive because it only upsets people and creates increased tension.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's certainly the case. I mean, I'm curious here your general thoughts on what potentially could come of this. I mean, it seems like such a flashpoint here. Also, you have obviously the situation in Gaza of a massive reduction there in electricity and other things. I mean, it's hard for me to say one way or the other what's going to take place, but do you expect that this could erupt into a much wider uprising amongst Palestinian people?
It probably already has. And I think the problem is or comes with interjecting religion into what is essentially a political conflict or a political fight. And this has been true all along. The Zionist movement has tried to use Judaism and Jewishness to be the criteria for its political interests in Palestine, and the reaction has been to involve Islam or the Muslim interests as a countervailing force when both of them are really very, very difficult things to interject into a volatile political situation, which should be dealt with as a human, as a political conflict that needs to be resolved on the basis of international law, on the basis of humanity, of equality, and respect for the dignity of all people, Jewish, Muslim, or Christian.
And, on that point, as well as of diplomatic negotiations, we saw Mr. Netanyahu in Europe in a little bit of a hot mic situation, it appears to be. He said that Europe should decide whether it wants to thrive or whether it wants to shrivel and die, with the implication there being that if they do not uncritically support Israel, that they will wither and die, and that the controversy in Europe over the settlement policy is wrong and so on and so forth. I mean, it seems to me that the Netanyahu government is so far, I guess, to the right here that they almost don't want to negotiate. Your thoughts?
Well, it's the arrogance of power. It's the arrogance of power. They are powerful. There's no question about it. They have a very modern technological army. They have nuclear weapons. They have submarines. They have missiles. They have excellent relations with the one and only superpower in the world, and they're throwing their weight around. somehow they don't realize that other people also count, and there are limits to pure military power. You have to acknowledge human beings and human rights and international law, and you can't just do whatever you want and say, I am powerful, I am rich, I am technologically advanced, I can do what I want, and other people have either to fall in line or they will suffer.
And I'm curious if you have any hope for this. But, I mean, it seems to be sort of a revival, if you will, here of the quote-unquote 2002 Arab peace deal that the Trump administration seems to be pushing, and certainly Saudi Arabia seems to be pushing. It certainly didn't get a lot of results in 2002. Do you expect that could be any sort of basis for broad agreement between the various parties?
Well, I think there are proper basis for an agreement. The only problem is that the imbalance of power has led to a situation where Israel thinks it can ignore these principles. It can ignore the two-state solution. It can ignore the United Nations and the international law. It can ignore the basic impulse to treat people fairly and humanely and on human rights. It can ignore the idea of equality and insist on basically an ethnocentric, this is only for Jews. And everybody else would either accept this or leave or suffer. The imbalance of power is such that I don't know what can be done unless we bring some prevailing, counter-prevailing forces to even up the field a little bit and give a chance for some kind of compromise solution.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a very relevant point, and certainly I think a lot of sort of the funk or the efficacy, if you will, of anything moving forward will be the role the U.S. plays in some ways. And I think what we've seen here recently, it seems that one other thing that just has to be done is there has to be more work to blunt the impact of the U.S. Congress on this. I'm sure that you've been paying close attention to this law, this anti-BDS law that is in the Senate and the House. I mean, really an anti-free speech law. And if the U.S. is essentially the negotiating position is on both parties seems to be like around this document, that seems like a major stumbling block.
Well, so far, the United States has not been part of the solution. It has been part of the problem. By supporting Israel pretty much uncritically, by preventing any effort, even a nonviolent effort like BDS, even any attempt to really balance the situation has been viewed as a hostile move. Somehow the position of total support for Israel is viewed as the status quo, and any change in that is viewed as a bias against Israel, rather than a bias in the interest of justice, fairness, and a solution, ultimately. This needs to change, because if it doesn't change, ultimately everybody will suffer, including Israel and the United States.
You know, I'm also sort of interested in your thoughts here on the continued ongoing struggle here between the factions inside of the occupied territories, and certainly as it concerns Gaza, it seems like a big deal. I mean, I think that the new Hamas sort of political document that was put out, I think many people saw a couple months back, that as potentially a bridge by Hamas to try to become a player in any sort of negotiations. I'm curious what you thought about that document and whether or not they really if they need to be engaged and how directly they need to be engaged for there to be some sort of legitimate deal.
There is no question that Hamas needs to be engaged. You cannot have a solution to the Palestinian problem, and certainly not to the Hamas, to the Gaza situation, without involving Hamas. It's the same arguments that were used to prevent the PLO from being a partner in the negotiations. You delegitimize them, you call them a terrorist organization, you criminalize any contact with them, direct or indirect. And then you say you want to solve the problem, you can't solve the problem. This is not to say, of course, that Hamas doesn't need itself to change and do a whole lot to be involved in the peace process. But right now, I don't think there's any effort to bring them into the peace process. The only effort is to keep them out, criminalize them, and use the fact that they are not acceptable, not an acceptable partner, to simply crush literally the life out of people in the West Bank, where you in Gaza, where you have about 2 million people who are denied electricity. They're denied water. They're denied food. They calculate how many calories is required so that they will be really suffering without starving. They actually have calculations on how many calories they will allow of foodstuffs into the Gaza Strip. It's a really horrible situation, and the only excuse for not dealing with it is because Hamas is labeled a terrorist organization and therefore outside the pale, and therefore they cannot talk to them, they cannot deal with them, they cannot negotiate with them, they cannot bring them into the process. It is a real tragedy which needs to be addressed, I think, very urgently.
Well, and I mean, you know, this is sort of a secondary issue, subsidiary issue, but I think it seems very relevant to me, and that's the Gulf crisis between Qatar and some of the other Gulf states there, and one of the issues being the political role of the Muslim Brotherhood in the Middle East. And it seems that the pressure that's being put on Qatar also is a reality that there's now fewer territories whereby diverse players in this process can really be brought together. And that just seems like it has its own problems for forging any sort of real deal here itself.
That is true. That is true. The only thing is that when you're dealing with Qatar and the UAE and Saudi Arabia, they are big players with lots of money and lots of power, and their own interests are so entangled with each other and with the United States. It's really almost hard to figure out what's happening where. For my part, I just try to look at the human elements involved. Is there human rights? Is there respect for international law? Is there equality? Are there guarantees for freedom of speech? Are we taking care of human beings or just playing politics here? For me, this is very, very central and very important. And as long as there is no respect for human rights, no respect for human beings, no sense of equality, I think all the maneuverings, the political maneuverings, are going to be ultimately ineffective.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, how effective do you think as a messenger Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority can be? I mean, it seems that, you know, not only in the actions they're taking towards Hamas, but I think historically many of the frustrations people have had with the role the Palestinian Authority has played vis-a-vis the Israeli security forces and the Americans, that certainly – And I think in the last elections, we certainly saw that some of those who may be wanting to push a little bit more civil disobedience and things like that also gaining some support in Fatah. I mean, I just wonder if the current leadership of the Palestinian Authority even really has the wherewithal to make the type of deal that people in the occupied territories and also in the diaspora will view as legitimate.
I'm afraid Mahmoud Abbas has lost almost all his legitimacy. He can only play his role to the extent that Israel and the United States allows him to do. He is beholden to them. I mean, he can't even physically travel from one Palestinian city to another without a permit from the Israelis. And he can only work as a subcontractor, providing them with security. He no longer, I think, speaks for the interests of the Palestinian people, which is a very sad thing, because almost anybody who tries to speak for the Palestinian people either gets silenced or gets delegitimized or gets arrested or gets deported, which is why I'm less interested in asking about the people, the individuals, than the principles involved. The principles that are involved are human rights, they are equality, they are human dignity and decency. And if these things can be affected, then we can have a solution. If they are ignored, then no matter who is speaking and no matter what they are saying, we're going nowhere.
And on that account of people talking and potentially going nowhere, any expectations for the UN Security Council meeting later today to take this up? Sweden, Egypt, and France called for the meeting to discuss discuss calls for quote-unquote de-escalation in Jerusalem. Obviously, though, that's a fraught venue. But any feeling about the efficacy of that meeting?
International law and the United Nations can play an effective role. The problem is it's been stymied by the UN, by the US veto. Anything that's substantive, anything that has teeth in it, gets vetoed, even though everybody would agree that it's definitely a good step and that it's a helpful step. Israel seems to have a promise of a veto and has gotten used to the U.S. veto to the point where when Barack Obama abstained, just abstained from a rather innocuous resolution that was viewed as a stab in the back. And Israel feels that now with Trump in power, they don't have to worry about that, that the U.S. umbrella, the U.S. veto is always going to be available to them to prevent any kind of effective international work by the UN or anybody else. As long as that umbrella exists, I think we will continue to see Israeli arrogance undeterred. But the minute that that umbrella is lifted and Israel has to deal with international law, with international public opinion, with the United Nations and with others, I think we can't have much progress until that happens.
Yeah, no, I think that's I think that's a very, very fair point for sure. You know, one thing I'm also curious about in terms of how that might play out is it does seem that, I mean, I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing, but I mean, to have so many sort of people taking point in the Trump administration coming who don't have much of a background in this issue, the fact that it seems at the very least that Jordan at the very least has had some effect in being able to modify at least some of the Trump administration's points of view, if whether or not that might be short-sighted on the part of the Israelis to believe that sort of this U.S. protection will always be there, because I think no one expected Obama to come in, and not that he was, you know, super against what they were doing, but to express some negativity towards them. I think we've seen in Congress, at least Senator Leahy, more willingness to question the activities of the Israeli military. If perhaps they may be I almost used a George Bush word there. If perhaps they may be underestimating the consensus that exists in the White House and other places.
Yeah, I think the United States policy is a strange combination of a number of things and a number of vying interests that are used and that are applicable. But in the past, it has been pretty consistently pro-Israeli to the point of nausea. I mean, they support things that Israel does which are clearly against the U.S. interest, which are against international law, which are against morality and ethics, and which ultimately really hurt Israel in the long run. Somehow they will always support it, you know, including this anti-BDS legislation, which is against the Constitution and against freedom of speech. And people think as long as Israel wants it, we have to give it to them. I think this will continue for a while, but a time will come when people's eyes are open and they change. And when that happens, I think it will be really shocking to people how quickly U.S. policy will change with respect to Israel and Palestine.
I think that's a great point. I think big change often happens very rapidly after long sort of glacial periods of change. So I appreciate all of that background that you gave us here, sir. That was Mr. Jonathan Kutab. He's a Palestinian human rights lawyer. And thank you again for joining the show. That is going to do it for us here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.